try and build something easy. And if it sort of works for that, then try something hard. And that's the strategy. So the next thing I did was building an iOS app.
It's like the space race or the arms race. If we don't do it, somebody else will.
The Genius Act, the Clarity Act, and the Anti-CBDC Surveillance State Act.
The fundamental question there is how you fund national security.
A company that has decided to take some of their treasury assets and to convert that into Bitcoin.
We have the 24/7 model versus the 9-to-5 model, but I don't think that's true.
But they did disclose they now had 33 gigawatts of capacity.
Welcome to the OrionX Download Podcast. Join Shaheen Khan, the OrionX analysts and special guests as they discuss and simplify the big ideas and technology that are changing the world. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to OrionX Download Analyst Roundtable. This is Shaheen Khan. With me, as usual, Adrian Cockcroft, Steve Perrineau, and Chris Krull. Gentlemen, good to see you again.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, hi there.
We've had a bit of a pre-call to discuss what we want to do. And without further ado, we're going to pick up where we left off with Adrian and his agent swarms, who are becoming a little army for Adrian and busily code. Go ahead, Adrian. We'll just pass it to you. what's up?
Yeah. So I've been having a bunch of fun trying things out. I'm not doing anything serious. I'm not trying to build enterprise software or whatever. I'm just trying to see whether the tools work or not. And as we spoke last time, I was playing around with some agent swarm code, a thing called Claude Flow, built by Reuven Cohen. And there's a whole discussion thread going on LinkedIn. So if you want to sort of dive into what's happening, go and look at Reuven's LinkedIn posts. You can see there's posts by me, there's posts by a bunch of other people that are sort of in this general area. And there's a group of us sort of going, well, what does this thing work? And then you try it and go, actually, yeah, it kind of works. And you go like, oh, well, it works if you manage it right. And then, so I think what we're learning is how to use a new tool that is pretty nascent. It's evolving super fast. It's a bit confusing and messy, but you can do amazing things with it. And it's analogous to the early days of cloud. Like when in cloud in 2008, you couldn't run a business on it. In 2009, you could just about do that. And at Netflix, we went and we used very nascent cloud technology to get the company running in 2009, 2010. So it's a bit like that. And now, of course, everything is much more sorted out and everyone knows how to do it. But at the time, you know, at the 2010, there were a lot of naysayers saying this won't ever work. It's not usable for enterprise and blah, blah, blah. All the same kind of things, pushback that you see. After that, so what I've been doing, I started off just trying to create a big thing in Python, just fairly ambitious, and it built a thing that ran. It didn't particularly do exactly what I wanted it to do. But so I kind of parked that and went, okay, the strategy for trying something tends to be kick the tires and then try and build something easy. And if it sort of works for that, then try something hard and see whether it works for that. And that's the strategy. So the next thing I did was building an iOS app, which was a lot harder to get working and to manage the process because you're shuffling code back and forth and running it on an actual phone and it's a lot slower. So that took a while. And then most recently, I've switched back to some Python code that I can talk about for a second. Chris, you have a comment.
Yeah. So I was having a chat with a colleague yesterday and he was wondering out loud about where does the role of experience come in? Now, I've heard you say in the past that you're not a coder all your life, right? But you are an experienced technologist, and you have a good basis for which to evaluate what's coming out of your, you know, coding efforts with AI. You have a good basis for understanding what works or is it doing it right? Can you help tease that apart a little bit for, you know, if I wanted to take something on, how would I go about understanding it and so forth?
Yeah, I think there's a level of, I mean, almost architectural understanding that you need of how something fits together. And I've always been more at the sort of architect level, right? I was a hands-on coder a few times in my career, but it's never been my kind of like go and build it thing. It's been more like, this is the shape of the thing I want. This is the technologies that I think are roughly the kind of thing. And that's the right approach for this. And the way it feels is that I have a team of engineers. They sometimes do what you want. Sometimes they reinvent things you didn't want. They like to elaborate on what you ask them to do, which is fine some of the time. One of the things I found, and I wrote about this when I was at Netflix, was I tell people to do things and they build a bunch of stuff I didn't ask for. I found that both at eBay and at Netflix. So what I ended up doing was an anti-architecture. I says, I want you to not do these things. I don't care what you do, but this is the things I want you to not do. So you put constraints around it. And you sort of have to think in that way with a team, because they will build stuff you didn't want and then spend forever trying to debug stuff that was you didn't want in the first place. So some of the time I've spent with the agent swarm is removing functionality that it sort of added in because it sounded like the normal kind of thing people would do, but I didn't actually really want. And cleaning that stuff up made it simplified things and made it better.
Yeah, so having a framework of where you want to go is really what I'm hearing is the key.
Yeah, and you need some knowledge. Like years and years ago, I built iOS apps. I hadn't done it for a decade or more, but I know roughly how the shape of building an iOS app works. I just couldn't write code in Swift. And I'm looking at Swift. I really do not understand Swift. There's a whole bunch of stuff that it's a pretty complex language. I mean, I can sort of read the code and see roughly what it's trying to do, but I have no idea how to write it. So I've now written a perfectly functional Swift app that does voice input, voice output, a whole bunch of other things, talks to the weather, talks to HomeKit, dumps out, finds all the rooms in your house, stuff like that. And it looks nice. So that's that was the thing I did last week, basically, get that working.
I saw on their LinkedIn exchange that somebody says, how come you're not using the iPhone simulator? And you said, because I'm working with voice input and voice output, and the simulator can't quite support that. So there's also, like, what you're doing is a relatively complicated thing to do in iPhone.
Yeah, it's a lot clunkier. So I'm using CodeSpaces to write the code because that's a safe development environment. And that's a temporary Azure Linux instance. And that's where I'm running my agent swarm. And the general best practice is you want to contain it. So the only thing it can do is work in its own environment. And the only thing that environment can do is push code to GitHub, because it's within the context of a GitHub space. And any code you push to GitHub can be reverted. So everything is nicely reversible and safe. So that's, and I haven't seen it do anything strange. I could probably run it on my home machine, but you know, if it gets the wrong idea, it might, you know, in theory, delete everything or whatever if you don't have it set up right. So this is sort of a very nicely constrained environment. But the thing I did this week was, you know, Monday morning I decided, well, over the weekend, this is actually another useful technique. I was just like having ideas. So I got my phone out and I have a copy of the Claude app on my phone, and I have the Claude and the ChatGPT app on my phone. But I went to Claude and I was saying, asked it, well, how would I do something like this? And just had this little back and forth chat going on and I've got a few different topics. And I said, okay, that sounds reasonable. Write a doc for me. And it created a document within the chat. And then on Monday, I went to, you know, my web browser on the same app. I went to Claude on the web and downloaded that document, stuck it in a brand new repo with a couple of lines of, like, this is what this is about, and told it to go build it. And at the end of the day, I had, like, the first time I tried to run it, it worked. I had a client and a server written in Python. And this is because it was all written in Python, it's a closed problem within the code spaces. It can test and run completely on its own, so it can iterate. So the first thing you try to run will build and run. I mean, it's not completely functional. I had to tinker with it a bit. But when I'm doing Swift development, it builds the code. And I literally have to save the code to GitHub, load it back onto my machine and start it up in Xcode, where I have my Swift build environment and my phone connected to it, try and run it, try and compile it, cut and paste the error messages back and the logs when it's running, and go back and forth. I'm cutting and pasting. It's still incredibly fast development compared to using a human development team, but it's a lot slower because I'm having to sort of iterate. And I haven't quite figured out how to have a local AI agent that's doing the build and test for me within Xcode. It's probably possible. I haven't quite figured that out. But anyway, that's kind of where I am. The other technique that's interesting is something that Kent Beck talks about, which is called tidy code, which is that you build some functionality you get it to a point, it's like a point, like at the end of whatever. In this case, it's like a day of coding. I spend the next day tidying it up, like get it wrote a whole bunch of tests, hundreds of tests, run all the tests, get them all to run completely cleanly, build demo examples of human testing, like tell me what to type in, run all those tests yourself, and then the human goes and tries it out. All of that stuff flushes out all the bugs, tidies everything up, cleans things out. And then once it's clean, you add the next layer of functionality. And that way you're not baking in a whole load of technical debt and things like that. So it's worth having these checkpoints where you just tidy everything up. And really, I think with the tooling, we'll eventually get to the point where it has that built in. It knows that it should stop and tidy everything up. But right now you have to kind of babysit it as you're doing it.
I saw your screen capture of the code as it was doing it with all the like a green and the yellow and the red pieces. And it seemed like the tidy up was a pretty significant process. It like reduced the code size by significant amounts.
Yeah, it's actually, I mean, it's editing at a relatively normal rate, but when you're running a swarm, the edits are happening in multiple threads at the same time. And when it's displaying on the screen, it's flipping backwards and forwards between. So you get this effect of everything shooting up the screen really fast. It's not really coding that fast, but it looked cool. So I made a little video of it and stuck that on LinkedIn. I said, hey, it's just like this stuff flashing past faster than you could read it. But what I was doing in there was I was refactoring it. So the structure of a Swift app, you have a view, which is what a page looks like on your phone. And as it was debugging, it just kept adding more and more stuff into the view because the view is its current context and it keeps adding functionality to it. And eventually you say, can you refactor that and pull all the stuff out into models and controllers because it's an MVC model, right? Model view controller structure. So you take the code and you strip the view down to just have the view elements and you have the, you pull out, you refactor it. So it had to, it took the code and shrunk it from like 900 lines to 300 lines. But what it did was it moved the code out and built a better structured app. So that was part of that tidy up phase.
Yeah, that was a fantastic.
And that was just the way when you're tinkering with a UI, it tends to put things in the wrong place for expediency. And so you want to kind of tell it to code review it and restructure everything every now and again. Anyway, there's a bunch of tricks we're learning. There's a group called the Agentic Foundation, I think, that Reuven has started. They actually have a Friday morning, my time, a Thursday morning conference call that I missed because we're doing this. And there's a Discord where people are chatting about the stuff. Recommend if people really want to get into it, look at what's going on LinkedIn and sort of just try and follow along. I've seen various people just try it and say, wow, this is amazing. But you still have to figure out how to control it. So it's a bit like self-driving car. You have to pay attention to it. Right, they do drive themselves very cleverly some of the time, and occasionally they will wander off and lose their mind.
I think for a large class of codes, it's there and it's massively helpful. And in my mind, for that class of code, it's over.
It is. And the other big thing is it an open or a closed problem? And an open problem is like, write me a poem or write me a whatever, right? An essay or a... There is no, the AI doesn't know whether it did the right thing or not. A closed problem is like test-driven development. Like I have a client and a server. The client needs to talk to the server and it all needs to work and you should have sensible looking tests at the client. And you can tell when it's not working because you run it and it doesn't work. So the AI within its own closed loop can tell when it's done, right? And that's when you get super high quality output. Right, because you've constrained it and it just iterates very quickly within its own I can see that I'm done thing. So test-driven development and that kind of thing is really essential. So the trick is to take open situations and turn them into closed problem solving. That's the area. Like mathematical proofs, you can tell whether the proof, there are automatic proving things that can tell whether the proof's correct or not, right, without using AI. So it can basically go and try and find proofs. So there are certain classes of things that it's very good at. And the people that are complaining it doesn't work are mostly looking at open problems. The people are saying, well, it works for this, are mostly talking about closed problems. So you have to kind of get your head around that.
Yeah. Now, I heard that all of these agents and how much compute time they take in the background has caused the AI provider to adjust its policies and subscription rates and such.
Yeah, well, the one I've got running right now just said API error request timeout. So yeah, so we've just overloaded Anthropic again. I'm always running this stuff in the background now when we're doing something else. Yeah, what's been going on is you start off with Claude 4 Opus, which is their best model. And at some point during the day, like after a few hours of coding, it generally goes, ah, you're on Sonnet now. It's dropped back to the cheaper model, right? So that runs for a while. And then if you're on the $100 a month plan, eventually it says, yeah, I'm done. You're out of whatever. On the $200 a month plan, it'll go a whole day of intensive coding right now. But what they're doing starting next month, and this is a preview thing, is they're going to limit it more. And I'm fine with that because I'm just goofing around. I'm not trying to do production business use here. So I'm just going to keep going. And eventually it'll go, okay, the AI got tired and needs a break more often. Sure, I'll go and do something else. I'll actually go and do that stuff around the house that I've been meaning to do. And whatever, digging a hole in the garden that's been sat right. Half dug for weeks, right? So I think it, for me personally, it would be good for the AI to, quote, get tired more quicker because I'd actually have more time to do other things. But I think that's the, they have to figure out, one, this sort of free use thing is creating a whole lot of powerful business momentum. And then they have to figure out how to monetize it sustainably without killing it off. And they've got to follow that path. And so we'll see how that works out. But certainly the way it runs is relatively inefficient. Like the tooling could use a lot fewer tokens to do things. So I think there's a lot of potential for it to get the same outcome with a fraction of the amount of actual token use by just being clever about what it tries to do and remembering a bit more and not like blindly trying, oh, I'm looking in the wrong directory. Let's look over here. I'm just going to search everything. Where did that file go? That kind of stuff. Yeah. I just see it sort of thrashing around a little bit sometimes. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity for it to work a lot better.
Yeah. They need to move from like a lazy intern to like a consultant, efficient, experienced consultant model.
It's not really intern because it's more of a team of experienced engineers. For me, it feels like managing a team of pretty experienced engineers, not interns. Mm-hmm. They know how to code. They know how all this stuff works. They go off and have their own minds and they go off and randomly do things you didn't ask them to do.
I see.
It's beyond intern. I've done intern code is just terrible stuff. I've dealt with interns.
Okay. So that's good to understand if you're new to this, to recognize that the quality of what you're getting is not intern quality. It is a solid software engineer quality.
Yeah, I generated, I think I looked it up, 11,000 lines of code and 60,000 lines of documentation by Tuesday afternoon from scratch. You can go and look. If you look in my repo, it's GitHub.com/AdrianCO/, and this one's called the goodies, THE-goodies, which because everything's based off of Python, which is a Monty Python reference, and the goodies is a British comedy show that's contemporary, and I have a bunch of stupid naming schemes in there, which I won't go into. But you can go look at that code base. That repo did not exist on Monday morning. It's now got a substantial amount of working functionality in it.
So the reason I ask is because I get the sense that there's a large fraction of population that just doesn't believe that this stuff works as well as it does.
Yeah.
And then there's another fraction of population that believes it works way better than it does.
Yeah.
And there lies the social challenge, right? But if it's working and you're not believing it, you're just going to be left behind is my fear. So you better look at it closely.
That's why I'm sort of posting existence proofs. Like, here's the thing. Didn't exist Monday. Tens of thousands of lines of code and documentation. Yeah. It's got all this functionality. Super clever.
Yeah.
I just did this myself in a few days, right? You could do, and other people are trying stuff out and doing similar things. So it's mostly, do you have a decent enough idea and a few hours of time? So what, the next generation, like what are the kids in high school have an idea? They can, like, if they get their heads around it, they can build this stuff. You know, signed up to something. There's some, a program for supporting, doing business support for kids in school that I sort of, I'm looking at maybe getting involved in just to see, it'd be interesting to see what they're up to.
Yeah. Now, Anthropic announced micro agents of their own. Yeah. Are they consistent with the platform that you're using? Can you explain what they did?
What they did was, I think they looked at what Reuven had built and what other people had built and sort of abstracted out the first step at productizing it. So they have micro agents, and Reuven, like within a day, had rebuilt an entire system to use the micro agents. That's how fast he can respond as a single developer. He basically told his system, his agent system, to just go include all this stuff in and yeah. So that just provides a better foundation. It's like this is this platform layering. The underlying platform is adding in the common features of these apps, and we're just gradually going, it's going to move up. And I think the rate of change here is probably measured in about a month, this will be unrecognizable again. Like we've from a month ago, month by month, as we go through these podcasts, we're talking about a different set of tooling, a different situation, a different set of capabilities. So it's moving at that kind of speed right now. You have to be trying to keep up.
Well, actually, it was always mentioned that digital systems can evolve much faster than biological systems, which is one reason once you get them on that track, they're going to advance way ahead. And we're observing that speed here. Okay, somebody's going to have to pay for all of this. And looks like crypto is the way to do it. Steve, how's that segue for treasury companies?
I'll take it. Billions and trillions. So
what's new in the Bitcoin land?
Well, Bitcoin hit a new peak price again in the middle of this month, actually on the French national holiday. It hit 123K. And that's in dollars, not in euros. But it is stabilized a little bit below that. It's around 118K right now. Bitcoin seems to find these levels that it likes. There was a long time when it sat around 58K and people got frustrated, you know. And now we seem to have a quantum level for a little while around 118K that it's hanging around. But basically, we're very close to new highs. The price has been going up since the beginning of 23. We had our last big trough in 22. There was a market transaction that went through a very early Bitcoin that was $9 billion worth now in value. Now, $9 billion is half a year's production. Our minting rate right now for Bitcoin at the current price, and with, you know, the limitation in the supply that you can create, which is 450 per day, is 19 billion per year. And there was a transaction that went through for 9 billion, and the market absorbed it quite well. It kind of spiked down to around 115 or so, a little bit of a buying opportunity, but you know, it bounced back pretty quickly. So there's a lot of support in the market. And lately, the biggest support, and certainly for the year 2025, is coming from what we call Bitcoin treasury companies. Now, what is a Bitcoin treasury company? It's a company that has decided to take some of their treasury assets, which typically might be in some form of cash or near cash, like T-bills or commercial paper and the like, even money market funds, and to convert that into Bitcoin. And this all really started with Michael Saylor, who began this in August of 2020. So that's now 5 years. And he went from nothing to nearly 700,000 Bitcoin in the past 5 years. And the amazing thing is that he acquired more Bitcoin in the past year and a half than he did in the first 3.5 years. So he's got this reflexive flywheel that as he gets bigger, it's actually easier for him to attract more capital. And he initially did that through the conventional idea of I can issue some MicroStrategy shares. The company is now just called Strategy, but MSTR is the symbol. I can issue some shares or I can float some debt. You know, that was kind of the normal way you'd think. And then use that money to buy Bitcoin. But he and the individual who was his CFO, who is now the CEO, he's moved up to chairman, figured out that there were many opportunities for financial engineering and to create different vehicles, basically convertible securities and preferred securities. So they have about four of these, and they now trade, you know, on the markets with their own symbols. So people can buy STRK or STRF or STRD, and they'll have different terms, and some are convertible and, you know, different yields, but the yields are quite substantial, 8 or 9%. And the latest one is just an alternative to commercial paper. So this is really a very large, you know, marketplace that amounts to something like $7 trillion between money market funds and commercial paper. And this becomes an alternative for that because it's for short-term money. They're going to keep it at par. The whole idea with money market funds is, you know, you don't break the buck, right? You keep it at a dollar. And for commercial paper as well. So it's short term, it's 90 days, and it's typically, you know, backed by government paper or high quality commercial paper in these money market funds. And this is all relevant to some legislation that just got passed as well. So I'll come on to that. But he's been so successful with this that many other companies are jumping into the fray. And there are now over 100, roughly 150 of these so-called Bitcoin treasury companies. And what you find is that they have been adding collectively each quarter, they've been adding about 100,000 Bitcoin. Now, 100,000 Bitcoin, you know, at $100,000, that's 10 to the fifth squared, 10 to the 10th, that's $10 billion. It's more than $10 billion that they're adding per quarter. And for the last three quarters, they've been more important than the ETFs. So the ETFs were the story for 2024 as a new channel for retail investors to put money, including retirement funds, into, you know, Bitcoin custody through, you know, a dozen different companies. And those have been very successful. They were the most successful ETFs out of the gate, really, in history. And yet now the Bitcoin treasury companies are acquiring even more Bitcoin than those guys do. So there's a lot of capital, institutional capital, that are coming in. So you have the ETFs, you have the Bitcoin treasury companies, and the third category here is governments. And there's some small countries that were the initial ones to put their toe in the water. People have probably heard of El Salvador. But another one is a little country in the Himalayas, Bhutan, who have been doing Bitcoin mining for about 4 years now and then just been adding it to their treasury. But now states in the U.S. are starting to add strategic reserves. I know there's New Hampshire, there's one other who I forget, and then Texas has just passed a law for a state Bitcoin reserve. And then over and above that, people have probably heard that the U.S. itself has created a strategic Bitcoin reserve. And more news came out about this week because they had a crypto week around the legislation that's just been passed. I'll pause for questions, and then I'll get into that new legislation.
One of the questions that hangs out there is we see these people that the institutions, whether it be corporate or government, investing funds that were looked upon as very safe, T-bills, et cetera, and converting them to Bitcoin. So what risk are they taking on by doing so?
Mm-hmm. Well, the risk is, the thing that's caught people up, and the reason why we had the Great Recession, has been counterparty risk. So when you think about risk, you think about credit risk, and you think about duration risk, and you think about counterparty risk. This is particularly in the bond market. So, you know, the credit risk, if you remember back to the Great Recession, that credit risk was because they were wrapping all these mortgages, issuing paper, pretending it was AA or AAA and selling it, even though there's a lot of crap in there, right? So that was the credit risk. The counterparty risk is that when the market went bad, that the banks weren't sure what the quality of the assets were at other banks, and it sort of froze up. They started trading with each other. So that gets into something called liquidity risk, but counterparty risk and liquidity risk are related. Then there's volatility risk, which is how much the prices vary. And if it's not commercial paper, if it's got some duration, you've got that duration risk, interest rate changing, or more generally volatility risk. So Bitcoin eliminates the counterparty risk because it's a hard asset like gold. There are really only two hard assets in the world in the monetary space, gold and Bitcoin. So really it's about the volatility risk. And the volatility has been very high, but it's also been steadily coming down, basically linearly with time. And so it's your ability to deal with that volatility risk that then determines, you know, how much you're willing to handle on your balance sheet. And that depends on your outlook and your time frame and I think your deeper understanding that the overall trend is very much upward price and quite strongly still. So you're able to deal with that volatility risk.
Well, if I understand correctly, some of the financial vehicles that MicroStrategy, for example, is issuing, SDRK and the upcoming STRC, is to moderate that risk, right? Because if you're an investor, you're looking at the dividend as well as the overall risk.
Correct. There are kind of two buckets there. One is regulation and the other is risk. So if I'm an insurance company and I'm supposed to invest in bonds, whether they be corporate or government, you know, I may not be allowed in some insurance fund, or if I'm portfolio manager for a retirement fund, I may not be allowed to own the master equity, right? Or I may not be allowed to own Bitcoin directly. So I need a product that's a lower risk product. And the STRK is a bond-like product, but it has a convertible feature. So if Master stock keeps going up because Bitcoin price goes up, there's a kicker. So actually, investors have been willing, and these are institutional scale investors, have been willing to accept low interest coupon because they have that kicker. This STRC is a little different. It's commercial paper. It's got a high coupon. 9% initially. They're going to aim to keep it at par, which is 100. And, you know, they'll vary that dividend rate in order to keep it at par. It'll be cumulative. So if they miss one, they'll get the next one. And then the important thing is it well covered? You know, do they how much Bitcoin do they have relative to these paper vehicles that they're issuing? And so that becomes an issue for the quality of the management.
So I have a couple of questions about other coins, so I can wait until you're done with this thread.
Well, I'm going to talk about something that kind of segues into that. So let me do that, which is this legislation. So what happened is that they passed three different pieces of legislation, and I'm just checking for the names. The Genius Act, the Clarity Act, and the Anti-CBDC Surveillance State Act. And basically, what they're doing is they're providing regulation for digital assets in general, and in particular for stable coins. And people have probably heard of Tether and maybe other stable coins. Most of these are tied to the US dollar. And what this does is this regulates them and says, here's what kind of assets they need to hold in reserve. They need to hold treasury bills or high-grade commercial paper, those kinds of assets, or agency securities that are short-term, don't have a lot of interest rate risk, and so forth. So they operate like money market funds, similar requirements to money market funds. They're not allowed to pay a dividend, which is interesting because money market funds, you expect a dividend, right? But however, if you own one of these assets, you can then put it onto an exchange and then you can stake it and you get yield from it. And that will be money market like rates. So there's that. There's digital asset framework in general. And very importantly, they're basically banning central bank digital currency as a concept. They don't want the Fed looking at it. They don't want the Treasury looking at it. And they called it Surveillance State Act because the justification is that there's a lot more instrumentation potentially in these central bank digital currencies that's going to instrument how people use them and surveils people's economic behavior and financial behavior. And then the last piece is the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. And there's a little bit more details coming out, but the basic idea is that they have transferred the ownership of the 200,000 Bitcoin that has been confiscated in various failures like FTX and so forth and frauds to the Treasury. So the Treasury's got oversight. And then they said, we will attempt to grow this reserve in a way that doesn't affect the national debt. So we'll look for other sources of income. And in Cynthia Lummis's act, which is gaining some bipartisan support, the idea is that the Fed is sitting on a bunch of old gold certificates that are valued at $42 an ounce, and gold is trading at well into $3,000, you know, plus per ounce. So if you revalue those certificates, you're going to get some free money, as it were, and you could redirect that towards Bitcoin, not that the Fed would hold, but that the Treasury would hold. So that's the general idea around the U.S. Strategic Bitcoin Reserve, is move that in the Treasury. It's not for the Fed. There's not going to be a digital currency, a CBDC. But the Europeans are proceeding full apace, and we expect them to go ahead with that. And that got reaffirmed this week by Christine Lagarde.
So we've always held the position that of the 20,000 coins that are out there, there is Bitcoin and then there's everything else. Or maybe there's Bitcoin and then the proof of work coins, which according to your report last month, there's only half a dozen of them left, and then everything else. So the everything else seems to be doing quite okay as well. So is there any legislation on how to regulate all these other coins and meme coins and, you know, other coins? Point one, and then what is your perspective on like a half a dozen or maybe two dozen prominent coins that show up right behind Bitcoin, starting with Ethereum or ETH or ETH, and then going down the list?
Yeah, I don't think we have time to go down the list. There's a framework for digital asset regulation. It's not clear yet all the details of that. It's pretty open. I think the other important thing here is that for the stable coins, which are, you know, one category here of these other assets, those have not been designated as commodities or as securities. And they're allowing banks to participate in stable coins. So we will see the money center banks getting into the stable coin game. And they're also being allowed to hold Bitcoin. And that's brand new. And, you know, the central banks have been against that. So this is really counter to what the central banks, including the Bank for International Settlements, have been saying. So you have these categories of proof of work coins. And the number two there is Dogecoin. That was in our report, but none of the others were because they didn't make the cut. Which was around $250 million annual creation revenue. So that's kind of where it is with proof of work coins. That's kind of where it is with stable coins. Most of the others are some form of proof of stake, which essentially is like shareholding, but that shareholding may not be a single company. You know, it's sort of like you have a broad consortium of companies. It's open. Anybody can have it and stake it somehow. But in the case of Ethereum, which is the most important of these, if you want to be a validator, if you want to be someone who validates transactions, you have to have a substantial amount of Ethereum. And that's about $100,000 worth. It's 32 Ethereum, and it trades, I think it trades around the price of gold right now, a gold ounce. So it's well over 3,000. And it did have a very good month because the institutional interest is picked up in Ethereum, and there are a couple of funds that have announced there is some ETF activity. Tom Lee, who's a famous, well-known investment advisor, is participating in one of these Ethereum funds in terms of creating an Ethereum treasury company. So we're starting to see that leak over into the Ethereum space and digital asset space more generally. But it should be noted that Ethereum has given up on proof of stake for 3 years now since on proof of work since September of 2022 and shifted entirely to proof of stake. And so they've moved away from the store of value fully over towards the medium of exchange end of a spectrum. But they remain number one. Solano, you know, is been gaining on them to some degree, and there are others that are fighting for position. But they're the leaders in terms of issuing, whether it be meme coins or NFTs or other sorts of digital assets. They've done a lot of work on their layer two. And so now the volume on their layer two seems to be larger than the volume on layer one, which helps their scaling.
And they're not fixed supply either. I think there are only a few coins that are fixed supply.
They're not. They've had burning implemented. So their inflation is now pretty low. And they've had times when they actually burned more than they added. But in general, they're adding. And the biggest problem with their monetary policy is it's done by committee. So in a sense, it's no different from the Fed.
Yes.
Whereas the proof of work coins have, you know, automated algorithmic monetary policy.
Right. And what's your view on Litecoin, which at some point was silver to Bitcoin's gold?
Yeah, I keep telling you to ignore it.
It's still one of the top 20-ish.
That's my view. Yeah, that's my view. It's
okay, doesn't do anything for you.
Yeah, it doesn't. No, unless you have a really substantial amount of hash rate. And so all you have to do is compare Bitcoin to Bitcoin Cash. Bitcoin Cash has the same supply, essentially the same code, except larger blocks, but it has less than 1% of the hash rate, and therefore less than 1% of the price and the total market cap. Yeah.
Well, as you all know, my interest in this is mostly technological, because I think a whole bunch of software is being written to manage these things, and some of that is really valuable, even if it is applied to a coin that I may not like. And Litecoin has been pretty innovative in some of what they've been doing, and they could, because I think it was easier to go test drive it there. So they continue to do good work, and I just think that fixed supply plus proof of work has some value by itself as well, ahead of some of the other coins that are doing really well, but I can't find, you know, like it's like another piece of software. If adoption is high, it's good. Yeah.
No, the important thing is that you need to get to some critical scale.
Yes. Yes.
Right. And that critical scale is the growth of the network. It's the growth of the adoption, and it's Metcalfe's law, you know, that the value in the network is going roughly as the square of the adoption. Mm-hmm. And Litecoin's adoption just has not.
Yeah.
You know, reach that level that it manifests as a power law.
Yeah, and actually, I was
actually
just
none,
ask,
none of the others really have as well.
Yeah, has anybody looked at the growth of other coins and to see whether they fit power law or not?
Yeah, we have. Mm. We have. You know, Giovanni and I have, and for a little while, Caspa was following a power law, but that broke. Bitcoin Cash has not done well in terms of power law terms.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, if we are done with the crypto portion, I think the other thing that happened this past month was the US AI action plan. So we can talk a little bit about that. I don't know which one of you has been tracking it in any real way, but the administration launched its AI action plan last week, and it was positioned as a mandatory imperative, other words like that, for national security. It has three sections to it, one to accelerate innovation, the other one is to build infrastructure, and then the third is to lead the international AI diplomacy and security. It's a 28-page report. It shows up online if you look for it. It includes something like 90 federal actions and something like, if I remember correctly, three executive orders that get added to the previous ones. The reaction from the tech community has been almost expectedly very positive. And of course, it means additional business that comes in faster for a lot of the technology players. But it is also true, as I like to say, that there are folks on the technology side who genuinely see AI as a critical and urgent issue for the nation, for society, and they would like it to be fast-tracked because of everything that it can do for humanity. Solve diseases, write code faster, automate things that we need to automate, but also for national security and global competitiveness. So therefore, those guys kind of want to charge forward. They don't want to be obstructed by things like risk. Well, then the flip side are the people who also very genuinely worry about the negative impacts of AI. And I kind of rattled off a whole list of it in the last discussion we had. Surveillance, data privacy, energy use. AI has now replaced Bitcoin as the culprit for the technologies, energy requirements that are impacting climate change. But there's also bioweapons, autonomous weapons, job displacement, algorithmic discrimination. And all of that is not to mention the superintelligence that might take over from humans and consider us pets to kind of be useful in some ways or not. So those are also really genuine worries. Even the significant ones are genuine worries, and they come from people like Jeffrey Hinton and those who definitely know what they're talking about. So the action plan does talk about some of the risks. They kind of articulate some of the things that need to be done to mitigate them. So they're not blind to it. They talk about it. They say, this is what you need to do. They talk about security. They talk about all of that. But in general, I sort of see it as a heat-seeking, risk-tolerant, go forth, err on the side of getting there faster kind of a strategy. And as a result, that means what? That means it favors companies that work on infrastructure, energy construction, hardware, other sorts of infrastructure. They talk about open source quite interestingly. So it benefits open source as well. They talk about skills training, and they do talk about risks and, I mean, security risks. And I think they're welcoming any effort that mitigates risks without slowing it down. I think that's kind of the overriding vibe that I get, is that it's like, move fast, and we'll figure things out later, but let's also put some guardrails. So there's a bunch of sort of multiple objectives that come through.
I hear about the people who, or hear from the people who are concerned about the lack, perceived lack of guardrails. However, there's also, as you say, on the other side, it's almost like the space race or the arms race. If we don't do it, somebody else will. And so we don't want to be second to anybody, and we don't want to lose our, you know, leadership role in so many different things around the world. And, you know, in hindsight, some of those fears were overplayed, but AI is so accessible to so many more people, so many more governments. So I think that's on the national security front, right? We need to be super concerned about not standing still or putting unnecessary roadblocks in the way.
Yeah, it really is a challenging situation, because you can't stop it, you can't slow it down, but you also don't want to have a Darwinian mistake in the process.
Yeah, and you know, and I'm going to drag us into hardware land a little bit, and it's a topic that we've talked about quite a bit, frankly, is Intel. You know, the new CEO of Intel delivered what you would call a lecture not long ago, last week maybe, about if we don't get a customer for their 14.8, then we're going to shut down manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's a very real risk to our national security as well. Yeah.
In our technopolitics thread, and we should revive that, we had one podcast focused on it, maybe two, and we should do more of that. The fundamental question there is how you fund national security. Do you fund it through market forces, or do you fund it through government ink? And the different models that we see on the world scene are producing different results with all the trade-offs associated. But when you entrust national security to market forces, you have to decide under what circumstances are those interests aligned, such that the market forces are going to see to it that you have it, or are they going to go optimize what they are going to optimize, which is like quarterly earnings and such, and you may or may not get your national security. So I think as it relates to Intel manufacturing in the US, owned by a US company, you have to decide, right? I mean, I've always said the race is between, does TSMC become an American company, or does Intel regain its mojo? That's kind of the race, and it's hard to tell which one is going to happen faster.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, TSMC has shown itself over the years, over the decades, to be a much more customer-focused organization on the manufacturing front, the manufacturing partnership front, than Intel. I've heard stories of people's dissatisfaction with Intel on that.
You know, that's true. And there's also this whole discussion of the Asian work ethics and the fact that everybody works like 24/7. And, you know, in fact, the latest report from a professor was we have the 24/7 model versus the 9-to-5 model. But I don't think that's true. I think that a lot of these stuff, as we all know, having lived at Sun Microsystems for a while, is what bets you take and whether those bets pan out or not. They went down EUV path, which DOE created and Intel funded, and ASML and TSMC made it happen. And Intel was a shareholder of ASML. It was a joint venture between them and Philips and others. So that bet panned out. The other bet didn't. It was like not supposed to work, but it did. You know what I mean? You know, McNeely used to say that when you're doing well, you're the best strategist on the market. When you're not doing well, everything you did was a mistake. There is a lot of truth in that as well, in my opinion.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Just from a 30,000 foot view, it seems a little easier. I don't know if that's the right word, to go all in and on AI. There's been a lot of market force development on that front that's built up over the years. And we hit a tipping point within the last couple of years with OpenAI getting the lion's share of the attention. But I think that the flywheel is certainly turning on the AI front, led by private corporations.
Yeah, for sure. And it's getting just bigger and bigger. So the other thing about this AI action plan that was interesting was that it did not reverse course on renewable energy, which is the preferred source of energy for all these big mega data center providers. That's where they go first for all the right reasons, because it's cheaper, it's renewable, etc. But that also means that it is viewed as a boost for fossil fuels. It's going to retain those or extend the life of those power plants, including coal power plants.
Yeah, and we're seeing a resurgence in the desire to restart or start nuclear energy sources. So I thought I saw a headline with Microsoft the other day that says they're making an announcement about some sort of advancement with their push to nuclear energy.
A lot of discussion on energy infrastructure in general. There was a report on how many miles of new power cables have been installed in the U.S. per year over the past 10 years and what that curve looks like. So power generation and transmission is like a big issue. Aidan, I know with your green shirts, you've been tracking all of this power usage and efficiency, et cetera. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I think most of the sort of short-term demand is coming from turning gas peaker plants on all the time. There are these gas plants that were really they're there to support the grid for short periods of time, but they're the cheapest thing to just give the extra capacity. And some places they're running out of, they're literally like they're constrained. They can't build the data center without it. So there've been a few cases where they've just installed local generation at the plant. There's a extra AI plant that is famously has very sort of, it's just spewing bad pollution nearby because they just went and did it. So there's a few bad cases where they've just done the very expedient thing, but this is very short term. In the longer term, there's a lot of the cheapest capacity you can add right now is solar plus battery. The second cheapest is gas. The price is set by the marginal price of gas. So so that actually is what ends up driving the price. So there's a few other weirdnesses in the way the market works. The cloud providers have all produced their sustainability reports for the year now, and the AWS one came out since our last chat. Their carbon footprint went up a little bit, but their carbon intensity went down. The business grew 11% year on year, and their carbon footprint grew a few percent. So their carbon intensity went down by, I don't know, 7%. There's the difference, right? So they're gradually getting more efficient, but they're getting bigger faster than they're getting more efficient. So that's sort of a sideways move right now. But they did disclose they now have 33 gigawatts of capacity generation. So Amazon is one of the biggest generators in the world. And the way that they contract with power is exactly the same as the way that, say, PG&E contract with power. They have power purchase agreements. So the people you buy power from as a consumer are intermediaries, and you know, they're just doing the same thing. So basically, they're procuring lots of renewable energy, and there's a nuclear component to all of the large providers, cloud providers. Now, they all three, you know, all the main ones have large capacity. The other interesting thing happening in cloud is that Oracle seem to have got some large deals recently. So they are really stepping up as a fourth player, particularly with large scale AI, and they've been very aggressive on price and doing deals and a big investment in it. So we're seeing very large capital investment. And then the other announcement, I think it was yesterday, a few days ago, was that Meta had their results out. Again, they're very profitable. The business is growing well, but their capital investment and their investment in AI is also driving a lot of capacity. So you have to look at them as hyperscaler AI capacity, because they are, you know, on the same kind of scale as the major cloud providers for their in-house stuff.
Right on, right on. All of the above: Microsoft, AWS, Google, XAI, Oracle, Facebook, Meta.
Yeah, and we saw Microsoft cross the $4 trillion market cap line earlier today. I think they've receded just a little bit, but that's largely based on their growth in Azure.
Right, and then you get OpenAI and other major players, you know, Anthropic and such, but also the so-called sovereign AI, where countries are now allocating gigawatts or megawatts of power, or aiming to. And a lot of that, what I'm observing, is going through the local telco companies that have already the infrastructure for connectivity and already data centers, etc. But allocating power, transmitting the power, extracting heat, transmitting the heat, getting allocation for GPUs, architecting it, installing it, all of that is a pretty tall order that is hard to do. Not a problem that money cannot solve, but it is big bucks, as we see. On that note, we've been recording for just about an hour now, so we can conclude this episode.
Good to go.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Thank you to our listeners for being there. Send us postcards and notes and messages, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thanks. That's it for this episode of the OrionX Download Podcast. Every episode is posted to orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comment section or tweet us with any questions or proposed topics of discussion. If you like the show, rate, review, and share it. The OrionX Download Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.